for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Bipolar affective disorder can be a devastating disease for those afflicted and for their families. Although treatment options have improved considerably in recent years, many parents struggle to support and get help for their teenage and young adult children. Joining me in the studio to talk about this issue, Dr. Christopher Burr. He's a clinical psychiatrist. Also here in the studio, Claire Dickens and Pete Early. Both Claire and Pete know the enormous challenges parents face firsthand. Pete Early is the author of a book titled Crazy, A Father's Search Through Mental Health Madness. He's also a former reporter for The Washington Post. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Dr. Burr, I wonder if you could describe bipolar disorder for us, what it is, and how it's diagnosed.
Sure, I'd be happy to do so. First of all, let me briefly say thank you very much for inviting me and these other two wonderful guests here. It's a pleasure to be on. Pete, he's made great contributions to our society and to awareness of mental health issues, particularly bipolar, with the unfortunate struggles he and his family have gone through. And it's a pleasure to be with my dear friend Claire Dickens, who I had the pleasure of meeting while I treated her son Titus for several years as he struggled with bipolar affective disorder. Bipolar affective disorder is a category of illness. Let me step back and say that, first of all, it's a medical illness, and it specifically is a psychiatric illness that is defined with mood fluctuations. And often individuals can fluctuate between having one or a variety of fluctuations of moods, which can be manic episodes or mixed episodes, or depressive episodes. They can also have hypomanic episodes. And it's usually subcategorized to two types, a bipolar 1 and a bipolar 2. And bipolar 1 is more severe. And the diagnosis of that, one has to have at least one manic episode in a life, and there are specific criteria that establishes that. And they may or may not have a depressive episode. A bipolar type 2, an individual has to be diagnosed with either a mixed state or a hypomanic state and have had at least one major depressive episode.
Is there generally an age range where we think clearly about bipolar disorder?
Yes, that's a great question. I mean, first of all, bipolar pretty much can hit any individual. It does not discriminate against anybody, so it can hit anybody regardless of any demographic factors. But there are two age groups that you do see a peak. The biggest peak is late adolescence, and another one is young adulthood in the late 20s. But you can see it in children, and it is obviously very difficult. It's more difficult to diagnose in children for various reasons, but you can also see it later in life as well.
Clinical psychiatrist Dr. Christopher Burr. Claire Dickens, you and your son Titus began a book together. He took his own life in 2006. Tell us about Titus.
Well, Titus, as a child, we were blessed. He was a charming, easygoing, bright, very articulate, and engaging. He was not depressed, sullen, moody, and things came very easily to him. I mention this because when he was diagnosed at the age of 16, having had no prior problems up until then, he really didn't have the skills to deal with this cruel illness. It took him so by surprise. He was just devastated and really didn't know where to go. He took
So it came on gradually with him, or all at once?
Well, it probably started in puberty, was when he began to notice a difference, long before we as his parents noticed. It's so hard to tell the difference between just a general teenage, being a little less communicative, wanting to party, wanting to go out. But with him, he was diagnosed Ritalin at the age of 15, an amphetamine, which he took at school. And that, of course, with his type of brain chemistry, was just, unbeknown to us, the last thing that he should have taken.
The wrong kind of drug.
He then went on to alcohol and various other stimulants. Not that he was doing any more particularly than anyone his own age, but he couldn't do anything. And we realized, and he too late.
Clara Dickens, she and her son Titus began a book together. It was published in Iceland, but is not here in this country yet. It's titled A Dangerous Gift. Pete Early, you have written a book about your own search through what you call America's mental health madness. The book is titled Crazy. Tell us about your son.
Yeah, crazy refers to our system, not to persons with mental illness. My son was in college. He was at Pratt in New York, doing well. And in his 20s, all of a sudden, he called me up one day and he said, "Dad, food doesn't taste good. I can't eat." And then he called me and he said, "Dad, I got up this morning and I took 5 homeless people to McDonald's to breakfast and talked about how we need to march on Washington." And then he called me and he said, "I don't know if I dreamt that or I really did it." So, of course, I raced to New York and we got him in to see a psychiatrist. And Diane, I'll never forget what that psychiatrist said. He came out and he said, "If you're lucky, your son is taking illegal drugs. If you're not, he probably has a mental illness." And I remember being outraged, thinking, lucky to take illegal drugs? And now I know just how true that really, really is.
How is he today?
Well, my son has had 5 major breakdowns. He has been arrested. He has been tasered by the police. And after I did my book, I have been to 44 states speaking about mental health reform. And I can tell you, my son's been tasered, he's been arrested, and I'm lucky. You know, I was in Philadelphia a week ago. 2 people came up, as they often do. They were both sobbing. Their son had committed suicide. Diane, both of them were psychiatrists. And they said to me, these are damn cruel diseases. And so I consider myself lucky simply because my son is still here and we're working together on this.
Pete Hurley, his book is titled Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Both Claire and Pete have mentioned alcohol and other addictive substances. How common are they in this bipolar affective disorder, Dr. Burr?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, I want to highlight a couple points Pete said. I think the title of this book is wonderful. It, as he said, it doesn't refer to the individual. It
Indeed.
Refers to the mental health system and the bureaucracy one has to navigate, which puts a lot of obstacles for an individual and family to get good health. And in the presentation of his son's illness is a very typical story. And unfortunately, as horrible, I think, as some of the things his son has suffered through, it is actually probably a better story than we often hear. First of all, bipolar affective disorder has many other psychiatric comorbid illnesses. You can have ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and often these individuals can present with that first. One can also often have learning disabilities or some neurological issues, tic disorders, or a variety of other illnesses, psychiatric illnesses that are comorbid with this, which can make it difficult to diagnose. I think a lot of individuals, unfortunately, as they're struggling with the presentation of this illness or the treatment of it, can reach out to alcohol or illicit drugs, street drugs. And because
why?
I think there is two major reasons, at least two reasons that I see in my clinical practice. One is that these individuals are really suffering, and they're really trying to find a way to cope with the symptoms that they suffer from, the emotional symptoms and the thoughts that they have. And I think it's very disabling for them. And they're at the peak of often their life, their late teenage years, their early 20s, late 20s, and they're making beautiful dreams and plans for the world. And all of a sudden, they get sidelined or handicapped with these depressive bouts, these horrible mixed episodes, which are a combination of being euphoric and happy and elated, but also feeling miserable and depressed at the same time.
Well, my son was not a drinker. He didn't like alcohol. But when he becomes manic, he has to have a beer there. And it has to do with brain chemistry. I mean, it makes him feel better. You know, there was a study done in California that showed that 44% of all cigarettes bought in this country are bought by people who have been diagnosed with mental illness. And that's because the nicotine, according to the National Institutes of Mental Health, says nicotine makes your brain feel better when you have these illnesses.
Pete Early, he's a former Washington Post reporter. His book about the weirdness, the craziness of this mental health system is called Crazy. Welcome back. We're talking about bipolar affective disorder here in the studio. Pete Early, he's the parent of an adult son with bipolar disorder. He's a former Washington Post reporter and author of a book titled Crazy, A Father's Search Through Mental Health Madness, America's Mental Health Madness. Claire Dickens is the mother of Titus Dickens. Claire and Titus began a book together. Titus took his life in December of 2006. Claire finished the book on her own. It's titled A Dangerous Gift. It was published in Iceland, but is not as yet available in this country. However, Claire does have an email, and that is T, like Tom, WD, 312@gmail.com. And Dr. Christopher Burr, he's a clinical psychiatrist who has worked with Claire Dickens and with Pete Early. Claire, Well, first let me turn to you, Pete. Describe what life was like then with your son after you went to New York, after he began behaving in this strange way. What did you make of it, and how did you treat it?
Well, unfortunately, we thought, well, this is just kind of a bump in the road, and we'll give him some medicine, and he'll be fine. Well, of course, it didn't work that way. He quit taking the medicine because he felt great, and then he got sicker and sicker, and I had to go get him in New York, and I'll never forget that frantic car ride where one minute he'd be laughing, and he'd be seeing these secret signs, and, you know, he'd see God as dog. Oh, God, dog, I get it. And then the next minute he would be crying and in torment, and just, I mean, the mood switches were just unbelievable. And I pleaded with him to take his medicines, and he just said, pills are poison, leave me alone. And that was very typical of the behavior you would see, is this sudden depression and then this euphoria where he could think he could do just about anything.
Claire, how does that compare to the behavior you saw in your son Titus?
Well, it was very, very similar. One component that was different with Titus was he had the addictive personality, and therefore it was very much harder to treat. He had the philosophy, if I'm going to drink, I better go off my medication. And this was an on-off problem for him throughout. The reason he wanted to help me write the book was he so wanted to warn other people that had been diagnosed, please don't take anything. Don't be tempted to do what your peers are doing, and even one beer. Although it made him feel good at the time, you cannot do this. And that was sort of his message in the book. He hoped that he would be able to tell his story very honestly and try to help people avoid the pitfalls that he'd fallen into himself.
So he was initially diagnosed as ADHD. They put him on Ritalin. And then what happened?
Well, then it was extraordinary because there'd never been any thought of him being ADHD, but he wanted to go to boarding school. And so we did the regular neurological tests in case there was, because he was becoming disorganized, even though he tested in the 99th percentile, but getting homework done, that kind of thing, was hard. And we didn't want him to go to boarding school, but my husband was in the Foreign Service. And so we agreed that we couldn't promise we'd be in one school for 4 years, and he wanted to go. So we had him tested in New Haven, and he tested, he had the highest IQ of anyone she had ever tested, but there was a huge discrepancy in his organizational skills, and so she said he's borderline ADHD, he needs Ritalin. Of course, at boarding school, we didn't realize that this was gold dust to a lot of older kids, and it began. The slippery slope began when he started snorting Ritalin, which was an instant high for him and, of course, the worst possible thing he could have done. And then he went on to drama school in London and continued to drink there, as everybody did, went to the pub after school. And this is when his illness morphed into something more. He became psychotic. He broke down, had to come home, and from then on, it was very, very difficult.
How typical are these descriptions, Dr. Burr?
I think they're very, unfortunately, as I said before, they are very typical and very saddening. Obviously, you've had very different outcomes. And despite the energy and resources and love that a family throws at these illnesses, sometimes you can't change the outcome that is going to occur. And I think Titus actually, for example, Titus got excellent care. As I said before, you often have comorbidities. And the difficult thing about bipolar affective disorder is when it doesn't initially present as a clear manic phase or maybe a mixed episode. It often presents with other symptoms that can be confused with other illnesses such as ADHD. And also, as I said before, you often have comorbidities. And so it's very typical for people to be diagnosed with ADHD, but later on have bipolar as well, or end up actually having bipolar disorder. Unfortunately, the stimulants, as Claire said, are some of the worst things to give many people with bipolar for various reasons. It does change the brain chemistry, and it actually can facilitate a manic episode or psychotic, you know, a psychotic state.
And how high is the risk of suicide among those with bipolar disorder?
You know, I don't have that data. There's probably Pete has a better understanding of that. I will say, first of all, suicide is a very complicated thing. I could discuss a few minutes if you'd like on that. But first of all, there are certain risk factors and protective factors that one needs to be aware of, or certainly a clinician does. But and there are certain people that are high at risk. People with bipolar affective disorder are at the highest risk of attempting suicide and completing suicide. And first of all, a little epidemiology, there is approximately 1 to 2% of people in the population that have bipolar affective disorder. And about approximately, you look at the different results, 10 to 30% of those will attempt suicide at some point in their life. And there's some stats that Pete may have better handle this, but have shown up to 10% of people with bipolar affective disorder will actually commit suicide.
Pete.
The National Institutes of Mental Health says that classifies it as depression, which, of course, is part of bipolar. And its figures are pretty wide. It says 30 to 70% of persons who suffer severe depression are considered extreme suicide risk. The general number that they throw out with bipolar, just bipolar, usually bipolar 1, is as many as 40% of people who suffer from that. But, Diane, I want to make a point on this. We spend a lot of time saying, is it bipolar 1, is it bipolar 2? My son's been diagnosed as bipolar 1. He's been diagnosed as schizoaffective, and he's been diagnosed as pre-schizophrenic. A schizophrenic is a thought disorder. I see two of you instead of one. I hear voices. Schizoaffective is kind of the bridge in between to make it kind of simple. My point is, these are very tough illnesses that they kind of blend a lot of things together. When my son has a manic phase, he also can hear voices. And what is frustrating as a parent is two things. One, of my son's six psychiatrists, only one has known anything but his name and his symptoms. And that's because, unlike Dr. Byrne, most of these guys are trained to issue pills. You let the social workers deal with the rest of it. You get 15 minutes because the insurance company is pressuring the doctor. He comes in and he says, okay, let's try lithium. Oh, it works. Oh, well, you must have bipolar disorder. And my son, like Titus, got the wrong diagnosis early on, got the wrong medication, had a manic episode, ended up driving down a highway, couldn't tell if he was awake or asleep, took his hands off the wheel, ran into a parked car. And that was later traced back to getting the wrong kind of med at that time. So that's one of the very frustrating things about this as a parent, is trying to figure out exactly what that is. And then getting a doctor to actually spend time to get to know your person to give you the right medication.
Claire, did you experience that same kind of confusion?
Absolutely. I think Titus had almost every diagnosis at one point that it was possible to have, and he was very often in this mixed state, which is a combination of manic and depressed at the same time. Then he began have these psychoses where he was hearing voices, and this ultimately was what took over. He could no longer hear what we were saying to him. If the voices told him to do something, he couldn't get rid of that, these voices that tormented him.
How dangerous were those voices?
Very dangerous. Mainly, they were telling, this was latterly, because I have to say Titus was always very hopeful. He did not talk about suicide a lot. And as he talks about in the book, he so wanted to go on. He was on his way to Iceland for more rehab, but also to finish writing. And then he hoped to be able to talk to people. And so he was not sitting in a corner thinking about suicide at all, but it was a spur of the moment. The voices were too strong.
It must have been very encouraging to you that he agreed to write the book with you.
It was wonderful, because I'd asked for his permission for me to write, and I said, if you could add anything. he'd said originally, maybe I'll just write an intro or a little bit at the end. And then he said, no, I'd like to do chapter by chapter. And he became so excited when he'd written something.
And involved.
If there's time, I would like to just read his introduction.
Please.
Should I do that now?
Please.
This is how he begins in the preface. I talk about the illness, and then he says, each of us is born with a light inside us. It radiates from within us. It animates us. It beams from our face when we smile or laugh. You can see it in our eyes. You can say that it comes from God or from your soul or simply from your nervous system if you want to. The important thing is that it is within all of us. It's a wonderful thing when we observe this light still flickering, even in someone who's very old. Equally, it is sad when we see someone, especially a young person, in whom the light has diminished or gone out. This is the story of how I lost my light. In fact, I hope to rekindle it by writing this. Let me make it clear now that I'm not an expert. I don't have the answers to provide. I'm not a Deepak Chopra who can say, do this, this, and this, and you will be well and you will be happy. I'm not always well, and I'm not always happy. I don't know. But I'm hoping that writing this project will help me come to a greater understanding of what has happened to me. It is a way of remembering all the events, all the actions, and all the consequences which have led me to this point in my life in the writing of this book, so that perhaps in the end I can say, well, I don't know what Deepak Chopra knows, and I probably never will, but I did this, this, and this, and my light sure as hell went out.
Claire Dickens, the mother of Titus Dickens, together they began writing this book. It's called A Dangerous Gift. And if you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. At 27 before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. He was so hopeful. He was so optimistic.
He was.
About writing this book and what it could mean, not only for him, but for others. And then you were on your way to see your younger son's play.
Yes.
You were driving in a car.
Yes.
And what happened? He was how old by this time?
He was just 25. And he'd spoken to my son, other son, the night before. He was looking forward to seeing him in his play. But he had been hospitalized 2 weeks before at Thanksgiving. He'd been off his medication for 2 weeks, which we didn't realize, which seems hard. But at 25, you know, you can't feed. Anyway, he had come home, but he was on the medication, but was not on what he'd been on before. So he'd gone off his original psychotic medication a couple of weeks before. He became very agitated the night before and was knocking on my door, not sleeping, asking. He thought that something was going to happen to me. And in the morning he said, I haven't slept, I'm not coming with you. And I said, yes, we're not leaving you, you're coming. And so we took off and he sat in the back and I held his hand and I said, Titus, are you all right? And he said, yes. But I'm such a mess, he said. And I said, are the voices bothering you? No, he said, it's not that. So we drove to the other side of the Verrazano Bridge. So we were only half an hour from my son's school. We were in traffic, and he opened the back door with no warning at all and jumped out, ran back to the bridge we'd crossed, and without any hesitation, he jumped. There was nothing anyone could do.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
I would just like to say that my younger son, who was appearing in a play that afternoon, we couldn't tell him. We couldn't call him. So we had to drive right there, and he agreed to go on in his play, sort of in honor of Titus, and he did it, which was at 18. He was astonishing, his courage.
Astonishing, Max, indeed.
Max is the younger brother, and he showed just incredible courage and strength, and I think he did it to really honor his brother. They had a very close relationship. Unfortunately, there, a couple points I want to make about, unfortunately, Titus's tragic death is that his last couple of weeks were very troubling for him. I mean, he did come off the medication. He went to the hospital, but he probably had a difficult hospitalization where he was discharged probably a little too prematurely. And he was on a medicine that was extremely helpful for him, often used for refractory patients. And he was doing quite well with it. But for various reasons, he was not placed back on the medication and was discharged a little prematurely.
That must make you very angry, Pete Early.
Well, these stories make me angry because although most of our conversation has been about the problems and the horrors and these illnesses are just so horrifying, they actually have a very high success rate at treating people who have bipolar disorder.
If they're treated properly, appropriately.
Right. This is not a question, Diane, of us not knowing what to do. We know that 60% of persons with serious mental illness like bipolar, schizophrenia, major depression are helped by medication. Recovery rates go even higher if you add programs, housing, jobs, ACT teams, good care. So it's a question of us just not wanting to do it. And hurts as a parent.
But at the same time, as you heard Claire say, I mean, this young man had reached a point in his life where he was not going to be told what to do.
And, you understand that as the parent, trust me, you understand that you suffer because you love someone who's hurting. But that person suffers even more because of the illness.
Pete Early, his book is titled Crazy. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy, by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary. On the web at healthreform.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, as the Supreme Court takes its summer recess, we look back on the court's decisions this term and look ahead to what faces Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor, with Adam Liptak, who covers the court for The New York Times. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. It's time to open the phones as we talk about bipolar disorder and the both craziness of the system as it attempts to treat bipolar disorder in young people, as well as the devastating effects on friends and family. Let's go first to Tamarack, Florida. Good morning, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning, Diane. I love your show, by the way.
Thank you.
My wife is 62 years old, so I really don't believe it just affects young people. She does things like hide things and always afraid of people coming in, and I had to change the locks a couple times. So it really affects the spouse too as well. And I was wondering if taking pain medication would exacerbate her condition.
What kind of pain medication?
She's taking a product called, it's an opiate for her back, morphine.
You know, Steve, this is Dr. Burr. You know, obviously, you're raising a good question, and I'll speak in a more general term. First of all, I want to say bipolar affective disorder and all mental illnesses are very treatable, and bipolar affective disorders are very treatable, but they need early and good diagnosis. The differential diagnosis needs to be made, and one needs to accurately diagnose it and aggressively treat it with a multiple of array of approaches, often including medications, including individual group therapy or family therapy and education.
But that clearly is not what he's talking about.
No, but I want it. That's good.
He's talking about a medication-induced kind of behavior, perhaps.
Yes. And
rather than, you know, simply crazy behavior, it could be medically induced behavior, Pete.
Well, you know, I'm not a doctor, and I assume that some medication you take can induce that kind of behavior. But we're talking about long term. We're talking about personality changes. I would think one way to try to solve that as a layperson is stop taking that medication
exactly.
and see what happens.
Exactly.
And that is not what you want to do if you have a bipolar and you're very, very ill.
All right. Let's go to Carla in Boca Raton, Florida. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call again.
Could you speak up, please, Carla?
Yes, I want to know if image is screen name SPECT, S-P-E-C, they claim that it's used to diagnose bipolar, and there is a doctor in Washington, D.C., the name is Amin Clinic, that does that. I want to know if this has some scientific support and it does work.
All right, Dr. Burr, do you want to comment?
I'll be happy. I missed the first point. I heard the thing about the Amin Clinic, but what was the first part of the question?
Something about SPEC.
Oh, I think she's talking about spectroscopy. This is a SPECT scan that is often done. Look at the blood flow of the brain. And, you know, I don't think as in psychiatry, I think we're going to be there in 5, 10, 20 years. But I don't think we are adequately there to look at the blood flow and to diagnose certain illnesses. I think there are tools that can guide us. And the Amin Clinic does have a large database, I believe, of 10,000 studies. But I don't think they've made those studies available to other researchers to really objectively evaluate it. But let me say this. Psychiatric disorder is a clinical disorder. It is not. It's a diagnosed by taking a history.
All right, let's go to Wendy in Alexandria, Virginia. You're on the air.
Hi. My name's Wendy. I'm sorry, I'm a little nervous. I have bipolar disorder, type 5, post-traumatic stress disorder, recurring or clinical depression, and associated associative disorders. I think primarily what I want to say is that even though I've received absolutely the best care possible since I was initially diagnosed as depressive back in the early 80s, I have still had multiple hospitalizations, several serious suicide attempts, including one where I did actually die, but they brought me back. It is very difficult to treat.
Indeed, and I think, Pete, that's precisely what you've been saying.
Yes, it's very hard to differentiate between these different illnesses. The brain, you know, it's a complicated part of our body. And, you know, why do we separate it from our body? You know, why are we surprised when the brain gets sick just like the heart, and yet we don't want to face the fact that people get ill?
Here's an email from Vita, who says, my son has bipolar disorder and experiences mixed episode. He is currently suicidal. How have you coped with this with your sons? What should we do? He is on medication. He has a therapist that he will see later today that he's been seeing for 3 years. What resources are out there for support and vocational training? Pete.
Well, if he's suicidal, I'd get him in immediately. Obviously, you need to get him to talk to someone and see what is going on. You want to do your best to save this person's life. Sources out there. The National Alliance on Mental Illness, a fabulous group. I'm a lifetime member. There are other groups out there, Mental Health America. There are groups out there that can help. And there are specific suicide groups also. But you got to get him immediately to someone to talk to. You can't wait and just hope this goes away, obviously.
Claire, do you want to comment?
I know it's very hard to get someone, if he's over 21, hospitalized, but even if as short a time as he is allowed, if he could be hospitalized at this point, that would be...
Many communities have a crisis response team, and if there's one, they should call that immediately. That will send a doctor or a trained person over to make a diagnosis. If that person is suicidal, if they pose an imminent danger to themselves or someone else, they will immediately be taken in. But proving that standard is tough.
Exactly. To Grand Rapids, Michigan, good morning, Marilyn.
Good morning. I have a question on laziness. My daughter was diagnosed with bipolar 1 last year with a severe psychotic state. And wondering, you know, she's been on medication. She's been fine for a year. She moved home. She finished college. And now she sits around and does absolutely nothing. But notices through her years of growing up and read several books on bipolar in children, and I think the symptoms are there. It was funny that this came up today on your show because I was going to have a conversation with her this evening on it's time for her to move on in a couple months. And I'm wondering if I'm doing the right thing.
Pete.
Well, you should contact NAMI and go through what's called family-to-family training. The question for parents always is, am I enabling or am I going to push this person too hard? My wife, she's the stepmother, constantly kind of knocks me back saying you can demand more. And that's the tough issue is how much to demand. And people will say to you, let your child just hit rock bottom. Until they hit rock bottom, they'll never do anything for themselves. Well, we've heard what rock bottom is. And most of us don't want to have a suicide in the family.
And Pete, I want to make I think you raise a great point. It is a difficult balance between how do you be supportive and affirming to an individual, but also push them. But, you know, somebody who has, as this caller described, as laziness, you know, as a clinician, I'd want to know more about this. Is this a side effect of medication?
Right.
Is this a state of depression? Is this more of a psychological issue related to the frustration of dealing with their illness?
And we also have to understand, you as a parent, you have to change what your definition of success is. If you have a person with a severe mental illness, just as if you had someone who had no use of their legs, you can't expect them to go out and function. You want to set the bar high, but you got to factor in that illness is part of their life and their personality.
Marilyn, I hope that helps. Is she on medication now?
Yes, she's been on medication and
what kind?
She's done very well.
What kind?
She's on lithium.
She's on lithium. And yet
she started out on several antipsychotics in the beginning of a year ago, but it's down to lithium now.
And why are you thinking of asking her to leave?
For that same reason as, you know, do we do that tough love? Because she will literally, she finished the rest of her college up, and since then, she'll sleep till 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
I see.
If I ask her to do a minor thing like mop the kitchen floor, she'll just throw a temper tantrum.
Claire, what would you say to Marilyn?
I would say that I saw Titus in a very similar situation, and he was clearly depressed. When he was diagnosed with manic depression, he was always slightly more manic. But when depression hit, he was incapable sometimes of walking across a room or reading a newspaper. Sleep was difficult for him. But then because he had a hard time sleeping, he would then sleep half the day. And many people said, "Tough love, get him out." And he was incapable. I could see that he was absolutely incapable. And it's a terrible balance between this enabling and encouraging them to do something. But it's
One of the things I might suggest, you're, I think, in Michigan.
Yes.
Michigan has what's called peer-to-peer, which is someone with a mental illness becomes a friend or a buddy or talks, and you would be amazed at how that can change, because you get the parent out and you get someone else who says, "Well, why are you sitting at home? I don't sit at home. You know, let's talk about this." And so you might look into that, but start with NAMI.
Marilyn, okay,
well,
I do.
You know, it's not just the sitting at home. She doesn't seem to have a problem going to the beach or going and doing things with her friends. That's why I think it's more of an issue of laziness. And I've had several other adult friends that were diagnosed bipolar and seen the same type of behavior in them.
Would, you know, obviously each of these situations comes down to the individual. Marilyn, I think Pete has offered some really good options. And the first of those is getting in touch with the National Association of Mental Illness. I hope you'll do that. Thanks for calling. And Pete, here's an email from Emily here in Washington. You mentioned your son has been arrested and tasered by the police. What changes, if any, would you like to see in the law enforcement and criminal justice system to better serve people suffering from bipolar disorder and other psychological conditions?
Well, I love that question, because so many people end up in the criminal justice system. There's two changes I want to mention. First is every city, D.C. has it. We need more in Virginia. Maryland has it. Crisis intervention training. You know, police officers are more likely to and encounter more people with mental illness than psychiatrists do. And that's because of our system. So they need to be trained in how to react to somebody. You don't want Rambo coming in on someone with paranoid schizophrenia. And the second thing we need to do is we need to look at laws that were set up to keep people out of mental institutions because they were such horrible places, that set a standard of a person has to be dangerous to themselves or others. We had to find a better way than waiting for someone to become suicidal or hurt someone before we intervene.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And, you know, we've talked about hospitalization, and yet a great many people who were once treated in state mental health hospitals are now being arrested. They are closing these hospitals. You've got, what, between 1955 and 2000, our nation's population increased from 166 million to 276. You would expect 930,000 patients to be in mental hospitals. There are now 55,000, with more than 300,000 in jails. What did we do about this?
Well, the answer is not to go back to the old hospital system, because those were dreadful places. We want to treat people in a community. But we have to provide services, and that's the number one problem. You know, I live in Fairfax County, Virginia. The average household income is $40,000 a year. Fairfax, $150,000 a year. You'd think we had tremendous services. There's a two-week wait to get into a treatment program, a six-month wait to get a case manager, an 18-year wait to get housing. That is ridiculous. And that's because we don't adequately support community resources. And also, HMOs, well, boy, we got to watch what we're going to do here. And since 95, two-thirds are owned by for-profit companies. Psychiatric beds don't make money. In Northern Virginia, they've closed down 25% of all psychiatric beds. There's no place for people to go to get help when they're in crisis.
And how realistic is the insurance issue, Claire?
It's very real. It's we're still fighting the insurance companies, and we were told Titus had a dual diagnosis of alcoholism and bipolar, and we were looking for a rehab place for him for more than 28 days, which is hard. We were told several times by the insurance company, if he was just an alcoholic, we would pay, but because he has mental illness, we're paying nothing at all. So it is prohibitive, and that is devastating. And so hopefully by just talking about this and getting the word out, if some change can come about, it's worth it.
How is your younger son today?
He's doing really well. It's been very hard. It was his first freshman semester that this happened, and he went back to school, and he's finished 3 years. But it's still very much there, and it's very hard. He's very strong, and he's doing beautifully.
And Pete, how is your son?
He's doing very well now. He has a job, and he's been stable for 15 months, so we're very hopeful. But we also know that this is probably going to be a lifelong illness, and, you know, we have to be prepared for what comes.
Pete Early, he's the parent of an adult son with bipolar disorder, former Washington Post reporter and author of the book Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. Claire Dickens has finished a book. It's called A Dangerous Gift. It was published in Iceland. To contact Claire by email, write to twd312@gmail.com. And clinical psychiatrist Dr. Christopher Burr, thank you all so much.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.